And today I'm very happy to present our recent work. This is the microphone.
Yeah, you put it into your lapel. And then you put that on the belt.
Okay. Works good? Yeah. The recent paper working with Sabrina on the celestial recursion. And here is the outline of my talk. I will start with the brief introduction and a review on the celestial holography program. And since Anna already gave a very good introduction on the celestial holography, here I will more focus on setting up the celestial amplitude calculation. And then I will go to the main result. One of the main results in this paper is that we contrast the celestial CFT versus the onshore recursion relation, and in particular the BCFW onshore recursion. And we found that we can start from the celestial OPE to extract the large Z behavior for a specific BCFW shift. And then finally, depends on time, I will quickly summarize the second part of the result in this paper on the infinitesimal Z story. So let's start with the brief review. So the aim of the celestial holography program is to establish the holography between the quantum gravity in 4D asymptotically flat spacetime and the codimension 2 celestial CFT. And the one of the core features of this program is that we put symmetry to the front and the center, and we base on this principle to reorganize our observables. And so, as Anna mentioned, this framework makes manifest the infinite dimensional enhancements of symmetry that are hidden, typically hidden in the soft theorems. So the central object of the study is the celestial amplitudes. Which transform like correlation functions of a conformal field theory and provide the key entry for our holographic dictionary. And for concreteness, I will restrict to massless scattering and in four dimensions. And you can generalize, there are generalizations to massive external legs and or arbitrary dimensions. So let's look at the global symmetry first. The global Lorentz symmetry in four dimensions, we have SO1,3 if we are in the 1,3 signature, and SO1,3 is isomorphic to SL2C. And if we are considering the 2,2 signature, the SO2,2 is isomorphic to the SL2R cross SL2R. And you can immediately see that they are the global conformal group in two dimensions. And this suggests us to think about, can we change the basis of our amplitude so that they transform like a correlation functions in the 2D set. So for massless particle, we can parameterize the momentum as the following. Here, this epsilon can be plus or minus 1, denoting this is incoming or outgoing in 1,3. And here, this q is the null vector. And can be parameterized in terms of the celestial coordinate z and z bar. And here we have the overall scaling, which corresponds to the energy. And start from this parameterization, we can look at the spinor helicity variable, because the spinor helicity formalism is very useful in the massless scattering. And in our convention, we can write the lambda as this, and we have the lambda tilde. And here the t variable corresponds to the little group scaling. And to define the celestial amplitudes, Anna already gave you the general recipe, like how we can define the celestial amplitudes. And here I just summarize the step to do that is that we find the basis of the solutions for the equation of motion, and this solution should diagonalize the rotation and the dilatation simultaneously. And for this solution, we call it a conformal partial wave. And it turns out for massless case, the conformal partial wave is nothing but the Mellin transform on the plane wave solution. So that we can write our celestial amplitudes as the Mellin transform on the momentum space amplitude. And this is the for the global symmetry. And I will quickly say a few words for the asymptotic symmetries. The asymptotic symmetries is basically we start from the asymptotically flat space-time, and we ask what kind of diffeomorphism we can do to preserve these boundary conditions. And it turns out the asymptotic symmetries not only include the global Poincaré, we also include the infinite dimensional enhancements of the Poincaré. And we have the super translation, which is the angle-dependent translation of the generators of the non-infinity, and we have superrotation. This is the local enhancements of the Lorentz.
Sorry, remind me of something trivial? In five dimensions, the asymptotic symmetry is also infinite dimensional, or it's finite dimension?
In five dimensions?
Yeah, in more than four. How does it work?
I think there's some debate about whether or not you'd include something like a super translation in higher D.
The super translation should also be.
Yeah, the, a little bit like there's an order in R fall off that's weird in higher D that Wald would say no and Andy would say yes.
But independent of humans, what's the correct answer?
You can turn this off there. You can turn this off theorem into a statement of something like a Ward identity. And then if you act on like an enlarged phase space, it will induce an overleading, I think, supertranslation, I think is what I remember. But in odd
what was the answer in the end?
In higher odd dimensions, I think it has not been studied very much, the problem, because the nature of the wave equation is different in odd dimensions.
Yeah.
So for higher even dimensions, I think the status is that, I mean, sort of Sabrina already said it, but these asymptotic symmetries, they appear at higher order, you know, 1 over R expansion, so the diffeomorphisms are going to have faster fall off with R. So if you like plug them into the usual canonical charges, the charges will also fall off as powers of R. 4 dimensions is an accident that the charges end up to be finite. But whether you want to regard these charges as vanishing or not vanishing is whether you want to like allow for these.
So perhaps what happens is that in 6 dimensions you cannot construct charges that remain finite, which is okay because you don't want an infinite dimensional anyway in that case.
I mean, this is what Wald would say, but on the other hand, if you want to look at the constraints that come from the conservation laws for the large gauge charges, the power of 1 over R is going to drop out, right, in the usual Ward identity for the S-matrix. And you can still regard, I mean, the coefficient of the power of 1 over R is still like something that acts non-trivially on the asymptotic data. And can give you, in principle, I mean, we have shown that it still gives rise in higher dimensions, higher even dimensions, the usual canonical charges, if you don't throw them away, the coefficients of this power of 1 over R actually do give rise to the usual soft theorems that exist in higher dimensions, right?
So there are soft theorems, in fact.
Yes.
Yeah, in any number of dimensions. So, but then there's like
whether. Like, I guess. It's still, it's like a charge for a weird slice, but then you have to have a gauge parameter that grows to select out the first finite piece, and then it's like...
If you want to have charges that are finite, but you can still have charges that are zero at scry, that give rise to the soft theorems. Both prescriptions, I think, give rise to the soft theorems.
Yeah, I mean, that's what, I'm saying that I'm making it finite by just putting an R there, but yeah.
I mean, my confusion is based on the simple fact that normally two-dimensional CFTs, Vidazzolo is very big, but in 4D, we don't expect three-dimensional stuff for a 4D CFT, so that's just a confusion.
But
from this point of view of asymptotic symmetries, my question is whether I also see or not that when I do it in 6D, I find just a finite number of global charges that I expect for a 4D CFT, or do I find an infinite-dimensional symmetry that then I have to special four-dimensional CFTs.
The issue is there's an extra infinite number of symmetries, which is the super translations, which are basically, I guess, in this case, like global translations commuted with super rotations. And so in higher D, there's arguments for the super translations definitely surviving.
Has anyone studied super rotations in higher dimensions? The usual lore is that there are no super rotations in higher dimensions, but has anyone done
that? Whoever tries to argue it's defense. Like D minus 2,
right.
And then there can't be that. Like Joe Schwartz would say that there's no.
Because there are subleading soft theorems,
soft
gravity theorems in higher dimensions. So what?
But my impression is when they don't act in the spherometric with the same order, it basically is like it's not. Because even leading soft theorem in 4D is a secant algebra within like the S2, which is like large, because it's larger than, it's not very zero.
Yeah, I understand. I don't know. I'm just asking, maybe Sabrina knows whether anyone you worked a bit, but it was in higher dimensions, right?
I would say that if the level believes that there's just SD minus 2, which I think like for her and others might have.
Would it be fair to say that in 6 dimensions, the asymptotic CFT would be 4 dimensional, but the hint from gravity is that it's a very special 4 dimensional CFT, not a standard one, because it has many more charges than a standard CFT, or this is.
I would say more special than a standard 4D because you have it's an annul surface, so that already gives it some specialness besides this enhancement of the Lorentz group.
Yeah, go on. Yeah. No, I know it's outside the scope of the talk, so please, yeah.
Okay. Okay, so the one identity for the super translation corresponds to the leadings of the gravitational theorem, and for the superrotation, the water identity for superrotation charge is corresponds to the subleadings of the gravitational theorem, and this guy takes the exact the same water identity form for the stress tensor. So we can use the subleadings of the graviton to construct the stress tensor, and you can ask the one loop order correction and etc. And so the lesson we have learned from the symmetry is that if we have a holographic dual for the 4D quantum gravity in asymptotically fast space time, that dual theory has to admit a 2D conformal field, conformal symmetry. And the theory built on this conformal symmetry, we call it the celestial set. From the CFT side, if we think the CCFT is a normal CFT, we have symmetry. We have spectral with the OPE. And we should expect that start from here, we should be able to construct the four-point function or higher point functions from the three-point coefficient. And on the other side, the BCFW recursion relation tells us we can start from the three-point amplitude. We have unitarity and locality. And we have the large Z behavior. With all of this, we can construct the higher point amplitude. Since the unshifted, the original amplitude can be calculated by taking the residue of the shifted amplitude after doing the BCFW shift. The locality tells us this AZ can only have the simple pole. And the unitarity tells us at this pole, the A factorized into two lower point amplitudes.
Sorry,
yeah.
Small clarification. I mean, this Z is not the same as the Z above, right? This is true.
This Z is the shift parameter for the BCFW, not the coordinate Z. Yeah, I should call this like W or anything else, but because in the amplitude literature, people are used to use the Z, so I see. And moreover, in order to use the BCFW recursion relation to construct a higher pole amplitude, we have to assume this boundary term vanish. So this is namely saying when I take z goes to infinity limit, my amplitude has to be zero. However, this condition is far from obvious and is actually not true for every amplitude in the general theory. For example, in pure Young mules, an argument was made based on the backfield method in the reference one. And it tells us the large Z behavior of the color ordered amplitude when the BCFW shift I and J are adjacent, we have the following large Z behavior. So we have plus minus, so four combinations. The first three, the large Z behavior is the 1/z. And for the minus plus configuration, we have and then I'm going to show you how we can consider the large Z behavior completely from the celestial CFT side. And finally, I will show you the example in pure Young Mills, and we will rediscover this table. So now let's consider.
Sorry, but that A is the same A in this Bayesian transform?
A is the amplitude. Yes, that A is that A. Yeah.
This is three level, or
It is three level.
So could what is then Z here in the second board? No.
This Z. Let me write down the BCFW shift explicitly. So we consider I have this 2-1 shift. So namely, I shift the momentum of my first and second particles. So my P1 goes to P1 minus Z here. This is this Z. This is labeled how I shift this momentum. And since I have momentum conservation, here my second particle shifts by the plus ZQ. So the momentum conservation is automatically satisfied. And in this specific shift, my Q vector is the minus 2 angle bracket plus the 1 square bracket. And after some algebra, you can find this this shift is equivalent to transforming the celestial variables as the following. So if I z or z bar have this subscription, that corresponds to the coordinate on the celestial sphere. If just Z, that means the BCFW shift parameter. Sorry about that. And since I didn't do in this shift, I didn't do anything for the angle bracket of the 1, so I will now change my z bar 1. And similarly, and just look at this, how our celestial variable transforming under the BCFW shift. You can immediately see that if we take the z goes to infinity limit, my z1 prime goes to z2, and which is equal to z2 prime, and my z2 bar prime goes to Z1, which is the Z R1 prime. So this is exactly the coincidence limit on the celestial sphere. So this observation tells us we can use the OPE to extract the large Z scaling. So the idea or the plan is as the following.
So this is like an analytic continuation. So originally in sphere, you have a Z is really complex conjugated with Z. Right?
Yeah, oh, okay, yeah.
It's like an analytic continuation, right?
Here I'm working a 2-2 signature. The Z and the Z bar are independent real variables. So now we can start from the celestial amplitude. And I take, or I implement this shift. And then I take Z goes to infinity limit. And then I look at how OPE transform, and then I extract the large Z behavior. And now I'm going to show you how exactly this works, and we will look at the example on the polynomials. Step one, we can look at how the BCFW shift operation act on our celestial operator. So generally, if I have this shift, on the spinner helicity variable, and here lambda and the lambda tilde are 2x2 matrix. And we are working in a 2-2 signature, so the A, B, C, D, they are real independent variable. So our 2-1 shift is actually tells us for any I not equal to 1, this matrix is the identity. And similarly, for any j not equal to 2, this matrix is identity. So we only shifted the 1 and the 2. And for 1 and the 2, we have right here. we have little group scaling. And for Z and Z bar, they are the standard Möbius transformation. So Z1 prime is basically A1 Z1 plus B1 over B1 Z1 plus B1. And similarly, for omega 1 and omega 2, we have the boost. Okay. So since we have this little group scaling, and also, when we define the celestial amplitude, we do the Malling transform. This omega scaling will give us the Jacobian in the Malling transform. So combine these two things together, we know if I do this lambda 1, lambda to the 2 transformation on my celestial amplitude, this is equal to dz plus d to the minus 2h1 and 2z bar 2 plus d2. We will have this prefactor times the correlator with z and z bar prime. And here h and h bar is equal to the delta plus j over 2 and delta minus j over 2. The delta is the conformal weight and the j is the spin. Now let's look at the large Z limit. Since we have seen that O1, O2 under this limit goes go to the coincident limit, so that means for this guy, I can plug in the OPE for O1 and O2. And schematically, we have U12P. So.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Should I try to keep track of who is incoming and who is outgoing, or it doesn't matter?
It doesn't matter, because when we take the large Z limit, it always one going, one outgoing. Because the P1 goes to P1 minus Z. And when we take the large Z limit, this thing we can ignore. So it's always like this.
So I should always think that when I take this, one of them is incoming, the other is outgoing.
Yeah. In the, yeah, under the large Z limit.
Because is it true that it's, from a point of view of OPE, it's more natural to consider OPE when both are coming or both outgoing, right?
Yes.
Because then they are there at the same time, right?
Yeah.
Infinite past, one infinite future.
Yeah.
It looks like they should not be correlated.
It's a little confusing once you've analytically continued the 2-2 signature, I would say, right? Like.
Yeah, in the 2-2 signature, it's a little like, it's not, because in the 2-2 signature, we don't actually have the incoming or outgoing adaptation. If we analytically continue it back to the 1, 3, we have this incoming and outgoing.
ideally, I think we would hope that if we understood the OPE just for two outgoing in one,
right,
and then how to analytically continue it, we would know how to construct at least what you would expect in the in-out OPE because we'd get the out from the in.
But in, yeah, but in our case, we ignore the incoming or outgoing issue. We just start from the OPE or the standard form. So we will have this expression, and from the previous here, yeah. And by looking this, we know our CZ plus D scale as the Z, and we know similarly for the C bar, Z bar plus D bar, also scale as Z. And I know this thing, the Z bar 2 prime goes to Z2, and the Z2 prime goes to Z2, and the Z2 bar prime goes to Z bar 1. So next, we need to determine how this three-point coefficient or this OPE coefficient scale under the large Z limit. And now I will just quote the second and the third reference. They calculated the OPE. So I will just start from their OPE.
So in this type of formula that you are writing now, you don't need any label to indicate if these operators are incoming or outgoing. It doesn't matter.
She's fixed it, but she should.
Yeah, I should. But in this formula, I'm thinking these two are both incoming or outgoing.
Okay. And if one was incoming and one was outgoing, the formula would be?
Will be different. You will have slightly different coefficients. And also, for the one incoming, one outgoing, in the on the right-hand side, you will have one incoming plus one another outgoing. You will have that double sum. But here, I think they are both incoming or outgoing, and here I will just have O. And here, the G is the three-point coupling constant. And the beta is the order beta function. And from that transformation law, we know our Z prime 1, 2 scale as 1 over And for z bar 1, 2 prime, also scale as 1 over z. And the inverse Manning transform tells us for the beta function, if we have beta a p, this guy transform as z to the a plus b. And now we can just do the power counting. So for the first term, this 1 over z1, 2 terms, the OPE tells us the total z scaling is the theta 1 plus theta 2 minus jp. And for the second term, it is theta 1 plus theta 2 plus jp. And in order to have the correct large z behavior for the complete celestial amplitude, we have to consider the little group factors over there. So here I should have minus 2h1 and minus 2r. And then I will have my final answer. Now we can look at the pure Young Mills. We have J1, J2 goes to this. We have this three-point interaction, and here we have everything else. Here is JP. So in pure Young Mills, we know we only have the three-point interaction if J1 plus J2 minus JP equal plus or minus 1. Each corresponds to MHV vertex, and another one corresponds to MH bar vertex. And to be more precise, the first term, 1 over z1, 2 terms in our OPE corresponds to the MHV bar vertex. And 1 over z bar 1, 2 term corresponds to the MHV vertex. So for this guy, the three-point coupling tells us the JP can only be J1 plus J2 minus 1. And for the second term, the JP can only be J1 plus J2 plus 1. So if we consider the three-point coupling here, we will no longer have that sum over JP. The JP is fixed. And now we can write on the table.
Sorry, I'm a little bit lost about the physics of doing this OP. So as you said before in this paper of Nima and Jared, they consider this very fast moving particle with Z as a background, right? Because as you said, one is incoming, one is outgoing, so they have this very fast moving particle when Z is big, right? That just passes by a very soft cloud of other stuff, right?
Yep.
So now physically I would imagine that I can, if I try to remove this very fast moving particle, right, that I leave there some kind of line operator or something delocalized. there was something that was really passing by the full cloud from one point to the other. It's not just a local operator. I was imagining that this should correspond to the two very different OPEs that I remember Anna was telling us at some point, that the OPE, there was one channel when you form this kind of jet, where it's simple, but if one is ingoing and one is outgoing, that the OPE was more complicated. And am I missing something? I mean, how could we replace? How can we do OPE when we have a celestial sphere? If one operator is incoming and one is outgoing, it looks like a very drastic thing to do, much more drastic than when you have two particles that are almost going to the same detector, right? Then I can effectively replace them by a jet. It looks so different physically. And here, I'm a bit confused why we can just ignore this subtlety of when doing the OPE. How was the OPE that they had? You said that they had another formula for an OPE.
Yeah, okay.
How would the conclusion change if you had used the other formula instead of this one?
So actually, if you wanted to understand this story completely back to our momentum space, this thing will be pretty clear because they come from the spinning functions. And actually in... if we look at the spinning function, it looks like something... Yeah, I don't quite remember the power here.
Maybe one first part of the answer is that we're at tree level. So
yeah, we are.
Yeah. For the in and out, like that's fine at tree level for the...
So the epsilon are here. So when you have both plus or both minus, when you do the Mellin transform, you can just change the variable as omega p is omega 1 plus omega 2. And you will have the beta functions. And when these are 1 plus 1 minus, you cannot do this. Instead, you have omega 1 minus 2 and another, and you have another t. Something like this. And you have, we know omega are energy, and they are always positive. And you have another variable here. And when you change the variable and you consider the integration range, for the one incoming, one outgoing, this thing split into two regions because you can have two solutions to, if we constrain the omega p is greater than zero. So that's why in the for one incoming, one outgoing, you calculate the OPE, you will have two terms, and their beta function takes a different form of this beta function. So you will have, if I remember correctly, you will have something like minus 1, 3 minus theta 1 minus theta 2, something like that, and you will have another term minus theta 2 minus 1, 3 minus theta 2. And for this thing here, you have epsilon. And for another term, you have minus epsilon. But if you just look at this spreading function, that actually doesn't influence our story here. Because what we care is how the omega scale under the large Z limit. And this guy always scale as the Z. And I don't care, this is like, they should give us the same answer.
Okay. Usual OPE, I have 2 points, but from far away, it looks like 1 point, right? I mean, that we understand
mathematically.
If we have two jets, two particles that go almost collinear to the detector, it also looks like one particle. But this picture looks very different, right? Because as you said, one particle moves very fast with QZ, one with minus QZ, so they are more like antipodal, right? Rather than at the same position. So I just don't understand geometrically what should I draw? What is the picture? I mean, in formulas, maybe there are some.
Can I ask a related question?
Mm-hmm.
Are these incoming and outgoing operators really distinct operators, or are they related by monotonous
bar? We want them to. We want to understand better the extent to which they're like there's one operator that's sitting there. So one thing to be careful to too is like it. I think it's a little bit like the Q is not a normal momentum. Like it's right. It's this 2-1 thing. So it would be an in and out jet in 1-3. Although I am sympathetic to like is it an in and out thing in this. Once you do this like celestial torus and then Z2 quotient to talk about the point gray patch basically. Okay, so that was just a caveat to Pedro's question. And then to your question, I think ideally we want to understand the in and out OPEs via like some sort of like operators moving around each other and understanding how to analytically continue, starting from just the like out OPE in 1-3. That would be like I don't think it's fully understood exactly how to reproduce. I mean,
isn't the answer to Pedro's question that incoming there are two celestial spheres, one on which incoming particles come in, and then the other one with outgoing particles go out.
No, but
these two
are
antipodally matched. So if you have a particle that is, if you have two things that go towards antipodal points on the sphere because of the antipodal matching, they actually approach each other.
But that is still, that's why we could at tree level be fine talking about OPE, but I agree with like Pedro that it's like unclear that it would make sense. For instance, in the extrapolate dictionary view of these things, if we're only at scribe plus, we literally have operators in like the free theory near the like the sense in which the theory is free near the boundary. But we can talk about the OPE in 4D restricted to going to scry and then literally just talk about the fact, okay, these operators are kind of smeared out along scry. In and out, they're like so they're not like they're approaching like a bulk point or something like that. So I'm definitely sympathetic to that, but I think that the caveat here is that this is more like the pi rotation on the torus cycle. Like, and the question is like, why do we Z2 quotient that to talk about?
But in any case, you're saying that the answer is the same. I mean, I would also be confused about why you're using the in versus like out OPE here, because it seems like the relevant thing should be the other one. But you just told us that the answers would be the same in both cases, right? If you use the in-out OPE, you'd get the same answer.
So, because the step we care about is actually the momentum space amplitude. So, like,
but if you just look at the spreading function before you're doing the Mellin transform, they should give us the same answer.
I mean, presumably, like, because we keep track of the epsilon in the, like, in the Z scaling here. If we did everything, like, no mistakes, we should have taken that to account when we start from the OPE for the two.
The subtlety here is, like, when we do the inverse Mellin transform, how you deal with the beta function. In that case, it's very easy because you just sum over the A and the B. Or you have the beta AB. But for one in, one out, you will run into this problem again. Basically, we just reverse the engineer of how you start from the spreading function to derive the OPE. So you can just reverse every step. And finally, you should recover this, and that should give us the same answer. And now we can use this two result to fill in this table. So when we have plus, JP is plus plus minus one is plus one. And the Z scaling is plus minus minus. So this is 1 over Z. And for the second term, JP is plus plus plus, which is 3. And we know we don't have this interaction, so we don't have this term. And for plus minus, JP is plus minus minus. This is minus 1. And Z is minus minus plus. So it's also 1 over Z. And for the second term, the JP is plus minus plus. I have plus 1. And my Z scaling is plus plus, sorry, minus plus plus. Yes, I know. Minus 1. Sorry, minus 1, minus 1, plus 1. This is 1 over Z. And for this case, the first term also gave us minus 1. And the Z scaling here, the Z2 is plus, and the Z1 is minus 1. So this is plus, plus, plus. So we found the Z cube. And for second term, JP is plus 1. And this Z scaling here is plus, plus, and plus. Z cube. And for the last one, the JP minus minus minus, here is minus 3, ruled out. And for second term, this is minus minus plus, it's minus 1. And this is 1 over Z. All together, this is 1 over Z, 1 over Z, Z cube, and 1 over Z. And this is exactly that table. And before moving on, I have a few comments on this calculation. And the first thing is that here we are saying we are working on the pure Yang-Mills. But however, in our OPE, we ignore the color factor. And actually, we should restore our color factor. So in OPE, we should have O1A, O2B goes to the IFABC, OC. So in that formula, A and B should have the color factor A and B. And on the right-hand side, the OPE coefficient contains the structure constant. And also, if we just look at this diagram, we will see that the scaling we're extracting here corresponds to the color ordered amplitude. In the color order amplitude, we consider the 1 and the 2 are adjacent. So basically, this table corresponds to the J1 and J2 are adjacent. And that's exactly what that table is telling us as well. And also, if we just look at this final result, and we can immediately see that if we're in pure Yang-Mills, the J can be plus 1 or minus 1. And if we are in the Einstein gravity, the J can be plus plus 2 or minus 2. So just look at this equation. We can see that the Z of the Yang-Mills, the Z scaling for the Yang-Mills square is equal to the Z scaling for the gravity. So in this sense, we can say the double copy relation is manifesting this. And also, as we have discussed before, the celestial OPE is equivalent to the splitting function when we go back to the momentum space. So we can derive this thing completely in the momentum space. And when we'll find the splitting function, scale as z to the power plus or minus s 3. And one have to look for the proper little group scaling such that the factorized n minus 1 amplitude does not contribute to any z scaling. So if you take that into account, you will get the same answer. And for this discussion, we also have a lot of like open questions besides what we have discussed before. And we can also ask like how the unitarity or locality encode in the CCFT picture. And can we use the CCFT data to constrain the amplitude in the bulk? And a lot of more interesting open questions here. So finally, it's already 3. And finally, I want to quickly summarize the second part of this paper on the infinitesimal Z story. And for infinitesimal Z, this story begins with this paper, the work I did with Brown Group last year. And in this paper, we realized that the Banerjee-Ghosh equation derived in this paper, which can be used to constrain the MHV gluon, correlator, the color ordered version of this equation is exactly the same thing if you look at the BCFW shift on the Park-Taylor formula. So in this work, we continue this exploration, and we found that. So first, the BCFW as the angle-dependent Lorentz transformation can be interpreted as the energy dependent generalization of the hard superrotation transformation. And second, we consider implementing the BCFW shift on all operators. And this transformation can be directly recast as the soft insertion. And if we just look at the MHV gluon case, it will directly give us the Banerjee-Ghosh equation. And also, we extend this story to the super BCFW. And I will stop here.
Okay. So thank you very much. Are there questions?
What is the most interesting follow-up? Is it to go to loops, or what was the main purpose of setting up this three-level computation? Three-level, we know already, right? I mean, three-level, everything's more or less known. So is the goal to use this as a warm-up to understand something about loops? What exactly is the purpose?
Yeah, loop is interesting, but I feel like for the loop story, we cannot like directly like extend the story, because the first thing we need to do is to say like, can we, how should we get the loop level OPE if we can only like start from the box theory to get our loop level OPE? That will sounds like,
I
mean, we didn't do anything.
Exactly,
yeah.
But it's not the first follow-up.
Yeah, okay. So the first direct follow-up for this work is to understand, to see if we can start from this calculation to say something up to our bug. Because that OPE expression can be completely derived from the global Poincaré symmetry. We can think about that we don't know anything in the bug. I just start from the global Poincaré symmetry and start from there. I write down the most general expression for the OPE, and we can ask what constraint we can have from the Poincaré symmetry to constrain the OPE. And we can start from that point of view to derive everything here, and finally to see what kind of more information I should add to our box theory. So that's, we would like to start from the celestial CFT point of view to see if we can really do say something to the box. So for example, as Freddy previously comment, we can to see if we can say something like to rule out the higher spin interaction in this way.
Mm-hmm. And then another thing is like we want to understand like other terms in the OP possibly, like and that'll, I mean,
yeah.
You see like,
yeah, because here this OPE is just the leading term OPE. You actually have a lot of more terms and more descendants here. Yeah.
I have a super basic question. So I understand those scalings, I think, but the scaling from a bulk point of view, I think I also understand the scaling of the beta function, but from the celestial CFT point of view, how do we know, like, shouldn't, like, why does the OPE coefficient scale with the Z? It's confusing me a little bit. The beta
function in this
Z to the A plus B, and I get a bit confused because I thought that from the point of view of the celestial CFT, that should just be a number. So it shouldn't.
Omega scales.
That's omegas, because this beta function, how you get this beta function, you integrate over the omega.
Yeah,
you have.
But once you've integrated over the omega, you obtain something that shouldn't transform.
I guess the question is, or to what extent are you actually attaching to the beta function or just the deltas on either side of the equation? Because I think if you just inverse Mellin transform everything.
I inverse the Mellin transform and I have to keep track the omega.
So I think celestial point of view, like the coefficient should not scale. Like that Z to the AB should be there, but maybe there is a different way to interpret it.
I would interpret it as from the overall powers of omega from each of the operators involved rather than the coefficient of beta function. But
yeah, because.
So I don't know if she said something that was earlier. Yeah.
So because in the celestial, we trade the omega to delta. So once you see the delta and you know there is some omega sitting there, and I need to track how the power of that omega.
I understand.
Yeah, I think that at one point you said that it was like you read off from the A and B of the beta function what it is versus like I think you could just read it off from like omega to the negative, like the delta minus one, right? For each of the powers, you can just count the power of omega in the inverse Mellin transform.
Yeah, that's actually what I mean.
It's robust to the statement about the in and out OPE changing because the beta functions change for in and out.
Yes, the O R change.
Yeah.
I have some simple question for the supersymmetry. So what's the coordinates for supersymmetrical theory or for fermion theory in CCFD? Do you still use CZ bar or something else to represent the eta variable?
Oh, the eta variable is eta variable.
Eta variable. Okay.
Yeah. So for the VCFW, so for this case, we not only have the lambda 1 goes to lambda 1 minus lambda z lambda 2. Plus. We also have this eta ia, if we consider n equal 4 supernormals. This thing goes to eta minus. Yeah.
Okay. So you use the same eta variable.
Yeah, yeah, we use the same eta variable.
And do you have any relations analogous to this for fermion theory? I mean, the OPE here, you have a formula for, I think it's for gluon or for gravity. Do you have any similar formulas for fermions?
For fermion, I think the super function is always the same. I'm not saying the same. The structure is the same.
Okay, so you can apply your method to supersymmetrical YAMUs as well, and you will see all of the shifts are good shift.
Okay, first thing, I think
I
think you can avoid that, because most of the form of the OP is just from like the SO2R versus 2R and the thing
with
the integer weights. And then,
let me think about it.
This is true, right? With supersymmetry, all shifts are good shifts.
Yeah.
Just like how we can see that here.
So essentially what we're trying to do is see to what extent you can start encoding like the interesting physics, like the fact that this theory has like all shifts allowed in terms of restrictions on what I guess guys are coupled by the celestial OPEs. And so what that should just turn into some interactions are turned off that would give a 3-point coupling. Or one could also say that it gives us the worst scaling because we're not actually looking at the relative coefficients of like interactions between different modes.
Another question is more complicated. So why in the collinear limit? So when you consider the internal particle JP, you just need to consider the single particle state.
Yeah, exactly. That's
the next part. So basically you want to and presumably one could then understand like couplings between like if you had higher derivative interactions like between multi-particle states in some sense by adding that. And that should modify what shifts are allowed. And I think this is a window to see how the celestial OPEs that we've looked at is only a subsector of the all like OPE coefficients, for instance.
So at least, can you use your BCFW shift in CCFT to reproduce the result for MHV?
That's actually different.
I'm guessing based on your recursion.
The best.
You use your recursion instead of other method.
Yeah, you mean to like recover the
MHV.
MHV for
the
MHV
equations, which is the other.
No. I don't understand your question. To recover what the
MHV. For high point, yeah.
Oh, for high point.
So would I?
Yeah, I think we have that.
Sure.
Yeah.
I would say that based basically we're not making BCFW any nicer in this basis. So we're like right now, the thing that she showed is showing how to go from like the input for the recursion for BCFW to like the equivalent statement in the CCFT. I would say that the CCFT style of doing a like way to bootstrap MHV amplitudes is to do the other half of the paper, which is this BG equations, because then you have these null states.
Yeah, but I think
But it would be harder than doing it directly in.
I think he just asked, can we just start from the 3-point celestial amplitude to use the celestial BCFW version to construct like the 4-point celestial amplitude? Is that your question?
Yeah.
That I think yes. That's what the way.
But I think it's uglier. Like I don't think celestial makes that computation cleaner.
Right. Yeah, I agree.
I think celestial does make certain like differential equations that you can use to solve for the MHV amplitude cleaner because it's.
Yeah.
Basically, there's this differential equation that is like a null state.
Yeah. That's the Banerjee-Gauss equation. That's a first order PDE. So you can definitely just solve that PDE. And you will have your MHV gluon / amplitude. But yeah, for your question, the answer is yes. And we do include that calculation in the appendix. But that's a really like kind of tedious calculation. So not like as simple as what you have seen in the book.
There are no more questions. Let's thank Andrew.